Oregon. Mr. Bednarek?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonas Bednarek, and I represent the appellant, Zan Morgan, in this matter. Appellant has raised two issues in his brief. The first issue asked whether the district court abused its discretion in admitting other act evidence under the theory that that evidence was part and parcel of telling the jury a complete story of the offense alleged. The second issue that the appellant raises is whether the district court plainly erred in determining that two prior convictions were necessarily not related offenses because they were separated by an intervening arrest, thus not subject to relatedness analysis pursuant to Section 4A1.2 of the Sentencing Guidelines. Turning to the first issue, appellant believes that the district court did err in admitting prior bad act evidence of previous drug transactions. The district court believed that this evidence was intricately related to the offense charged. However, the appellant was initially indicted with one violation of 21 U.S.C. 841A1, which alleged one substantive count of cocaine-based distribution on July 16, 2002. In an effort to prove the offense, the United States introduced, over objection from the defendant, the testimony of a confidential informant who arranged the transaction. The confidential informant also testified as to the frequency and size of previous transactions between the confidential informant, the appellant here, and a co-defendant in the case. In the support of the admission of this testimony, the appellee relies heavily on United States versus Harris. The appellee contends that the omission of the testimony would leave a conceptual void in the story in this case, and thus would be unable to tell the jury a complete story. I disagree with that proposition, and I disagree with it because I don't think that the omission of this prior drug transaction testimony does anything to leave a conceptual void in this matter, when in fact I think that there is some information about the relationship between the confidential informant, the defendant, and the co-defendant, which may give the jury a more complete and replete story of the day in question. However, an omission of the prior evidence of prior drug transactions does nothing to complete the story. It simply prejudiced the defendant and, I believe, swayed the jury into a conviction that was unwarranted. I think it's important to note that the appellant in this case, wasn't actually present for the transaction that occurred. It was all circumstantial evidence that linked my client to this transaction. The United States thus used prior drug transaction evidence to paint this picture that this transaction occurred in a similar fashion. Now, again, I submit to the court that that prior drug transaction testimony wasn't necessary to complete this story. Now, there may have been some testimony that was necessary in terms of the relationships between the parties. Did they know each other? Were they using cellular telephones and talking in some slang talk in order to affect these transactions? But as far as admitting the exact testimony about the quantity and frequency of these prior drug transactions, entirely prejudicial. I believe the jury was influenced by this prejudicial evidence, and I believe that it should not have been admitted. Further, even if the evidence was properly admissible pursuant to an integrally related theory, I believe that the evidence is still subject to relevancy analysis. It doesn't appear from the record that the district court did anything in terms of weighing the prejudicial effect versus the relevance of this evidence. I think when we look at those two things, the relevancy is diminished. These are prior transactions on prior dates versus the prejudicial effect, which is severe. I think when a jury is facing a situation where a defendant has only circumstantial evidence tying himself to a crime, and then all of a sudden they hear about previous drug transactions, that's highly prejudicial evidence. Therefore, I believe that it was in error for the court to admit that evidence. The second issue raised by appellant is whether or not the district court committed plain error in determining that two prior traffic offenses were separated by an intervening arrest and thus not subject to relatedness analysis. Pursuant to the sentencing guidelines, prior cases that are related can only be counted once for criminal history purposes. Sort of a two-step analysis. The first step is determining whether or not the two prior offenses were separated by an intervening arrest. If the answer to that question is no, they were not separated by an intervening arrest, we can then move to the second phase of the analysis, which is, are they related? The judge in this case never got to that second phase because the district court determined that these two offenses were separated by an intervening arrest. I think it's necessary to talk about the initial offense. My client was charged with operating a motor vehicle after revocation of his driver's license. That offense can either be charged in a criminal complaint or an individual can be issued a citation and released immediately. My client on that offense was issued a citation. He was never taken into custody. He was never put in jail for the evening or anything of that sort.
What difference does any of this make since the other charges weren't consolidated?
I would argue to the court, Your Honor, that pursuant to United States versus Joseph, there was a functional consolidation of these two cases.
How is it possible to think of them as consolidated when one of them was used as a prior to enhance the sentence of the other?
Because they were handled on the same day by the same judge, and that judge handed down sentence on the two crimes.
Yeah, but the judge was obviously treating them as distinct, or he could not have used one as a prior. Right? You can't have a recidivist enhancement unless the defendant is a recidivist, and that means distinct crimes. Right?
Correct.
Isn't that pretty straightforward?
I think you're correct in assuming that the one charge for operating after revocation necessarily increased penalties for the second and made a second or a third offense operating after revocation. However, I don't think that's determinative of whether or not these cases were functionally consolidated at the trial court level. I think, pursuant to United States versus Joseph, there was a functional consolidation of the two prior operating after revocation offenses, despite the fact that one may have read the next, given that it was a subsequent offense. I still think that we could find functional consolidation as contemplated by Joseph under this fact scenario. However, the district court never got to that determination because the district court decided that the issuance of this traffic citation amounted to a formal arrest or the like, and thus never got to this consolidation argument that I put forth at the district court level. I submit that had the district court determined that they were not separated by an intervening arrest, we can then turn to this functional consolidation argument, and I would submit that had the district court done that, they would have found that there was a functional consolidation, and thus two prior acts which were not separated by an intervening arrest should have properly been counted only once for guideline purposes. It makes a big difference in the appellant's sentence because it bumped into the next criminal history category. So if there aren't any other questions, I will defer to my colleague. And
hey, thank you, Mr.
You're welcome.
Mr. Anderson?
Good morning, Your Honors, or good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Rob Anderson. I'm the Assistant United States Attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin. I have the privilege of representing the United States in this matter. The testimony of the government's witnesses in this case, which was challenged by the defendant in his first issue, is a prime example of what was necessary to an explanation of the events surrounding the charge, which is exactly what cases that this court has decided in recent years, such as Stenner and Harris, have addressed. It was so intricately related and inextricably intertwined that we couldn't really explain the story to the jury without presenting some of that evidence. It'd be totally different. All what we have in terms of facts here that went into the trial, all of the communication on July 16th between the confidential informant, Mr. Green, and Mr. Morgan on the telephone was about Mr. Morgan coming over, supplying cocaine base in exchange for $800 to the confidential informant and the undercover officer. Not once in any of the phone conversations, in any of the negotiations to get Mr. Morgan over there, not once did Mr. Morgan say, I'm going to be sending someone else. I'm going to be sending Dizelle Jones over. Dizelle Jones was never mentioned. So when Dizelle Jones shows up instead of Mr. Morgan, which is what they expected, there has to be an explanation there to the jury. The jury needs an explanation of why Jones would show up rather than Morgan when the deal was all set up through Morgan. The jury needs an explanation of what Jones's role was. They need an explanation of how Jones knew Morgan. They need an explanation of why Jones would make a delivery of drugs.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Morgan's co-defendant Jones testifies that Morgan called him gave him an ounce of cocaine, told him to deliver it to Green. If the charge in this case is simply distribution of cocaine base, why do we need any of the prior acts testimony? What probative value does it have? I mean, isn't the testimony from Jones enough?
Jones could come in and testify to that, but that would leave the jury without an explanation of why would Jones do that? Why would Jones, had Jones ever been involved in such criminal conduct before that he would go and actually do this?
Why? I mean, all they really need
because
to know...
Because it would then be unbelievable to the jury. It
why?
Would be,
all they really need to know is Morgan gives Jones the drugs, tells him to deliver the drugs to Green. That's your story, isn't it?
But without further explanation, it then lends it subject to the defense attorney getting up and saying, this is a totally incredible story. Why would anybody ever come over there, take drugs, and then take them over and deliver them?
So don't you have rebuttal?
Well, not to his closing argument to the jury, but it's exactly what Sensner and Harris are talking about is giving the jury the proper context of how the events happened that day, and that's exactly what this evidence was. If we had, we could have, on the verge of trial there, when we finally found out that Dizell Jones was going to plead, and then we had a little more evidence, we could have even gone in and superseded the indictment and done a conspiracy charge, and then all this evidence would have been probative to that conspiracy. It's no different that this is probative to show why and how that one, the substantive count, the substantive delivery on July 16th happened and how it came about, with the jury knowing and understanding how this happened. The simplest way to look at this, Your Honor, is if Morgan had simply done what he said on the phone, and if he had showed up at that meeting and done the delivery himself, much of this would have been unnecessary. But that's not what happened, and so that left the jury puzzled and wondering, and we have to try and answer all those questions for the jury and speculate as to what they are going to have problems with in digesting. So it was necessary to explain this interdependent relationship that these gentlemen had, and that relationship that was called into action on July 16th. And the testimony also explained from Mr. Green the code language that he used on the phone, which otherwise would not have been explained. Mr. Green had to explain, well, I used the term $8, that means 800. Well, how do we know that means 800? Well, in other instances, other circumstances, we had ordered the same thing, $8 meant 800. You had to place that all in context, which is exactly what the inextricably intertwined and complete story of the unfolding events is all about. Now, there was no unfair prejudice also to the defendant in this regard, because the government did limit to the best that we could the extent of what we got out. We only got out what was necessary to explain to the jury, this is the context, this is how this happened. And the judge even gave them a cautionary instruction, which in actuality, a cautionary instruction in this instance isn't required or called for. In a 404B evidence, you would give a cautionary instruction, but this was direct evidence of the events of that crime. And then finally, as to that second issue, I do want to point out something that the appellant has overlooked or not mentioned. He focuses on the fact that the judge made a finding with regard to whether there was an intervening arrest, but in actuality, she did. She not only mentioned that, but she did go on to say these are truly separate cases. They're docketed separately. They're charged separately. The addendum to the pre-sentence investigation noted that the district court or the sentencing court in the state level that sentenced him for those traffic offenses sentenced him based on two separate offenses, gave him two separate sentences, two separate fines, and that is what she's referring to in talking about these being two separate sentences which are deserving of separate credit, separate criminal history points. And he did correctly observe, even if you don't have an offense which is separated by an intervening arrest, you still have to meet the criteria then for them to be considered related. They are only related only if they come out of the same offense, they're committed at the same time, they're a product of the common scheme or plan, or they were consolidated for trial or sentencing. This court has recognized functional consolidation, we know that, but there is nothing in the record to support their contention that they were functionally consolidated. He supplied the transcript to the court, and that's what we referred to in our brief and excerpts of that transcript, noting these were treated separately. And Judge Easterbrook correctly observed as well, you had to treat them separately. You had to sentence on the one before you could ever sentence on the second, because they were in fact separate offenses. You couldn't consolidate them, or one wouldn't be a predicate to the other. So based upon that, mm-hmm. there was no error committed by the court in this, and I ask the court to affirm.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Bednar, does he have any time? 2 minutes?
Judge, when you ask, isn't the testimony from Nizelle Jones enough? I absolutely agree that it is. I mean, I was there. I tried this case. And when Nizelle Jones testified, he testified that I get a call from defendant Dan Morgan, my client. I go over to his house. He tells me where to go. He swings by and drops off the cocaine base. It absolutely was a complete picture of what happened. But suddenly then the jury is also aware of the fact that these three purportedly distributed cocaine base on a number of prior occasions throughout the years before in large quantities. I think that that's absolutely prejudicial. And that's when I argue that it's not necessary to tell the jury a complete story. It wasn't necessary to tell the jury a complete story. It simply just prejudiced them into believing that, well, if he did it that time, he probably did it this time as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Benarek. And you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your clients. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.